Hi, this is David Sachs, and welcome to Spiritual Tools for an Outrageous World. Every week we do a little couples therapy between us and God. It's a chance to deepen and explore our most important relationship.
Okay, I'm glad you're here. Lots to discuss. Thank God, lots to discuss, right? I realize that I say that a lot. I say glad you're here all the time. But then I realize I sort of like add lots to discuss. But that's a good thing. That's a good thing. I know when people say, you know, how are you doing? Have you ever had this conversation with someone? Busy. And then people say, busy's good. Busy's good. So lots to discuss means that you're thinking a lot, you know? And that's what we're supposed to be doing. I once was sitting in shul, and it was kind of like after davening, and so people were learning. And this, I had the privilege, this like old man with like a long white beard sat down next to me, and he was like the head of a yeshiva in Israel. And anyway, he asked me the following question. He said, how do you know if a fish is alive? So, and then I think he answered his own question. He said, if it's swimming, that's not proof of anything. So what? Then he explained. He said, because the tide could just be taking the fish downstream. So the fact that the fish is moving actually isn't evidence of anything. He said, if the fish is swimming upstream against the tide, that's proof that it's alive. So his point was, how do you know if you're alive? Right? So if you're kind of just flowing, and it's good to flow, but it's good to flow upstream, which is a bit of a paradox, or if that's the right word. Meaning to say, one should feel comfortable and at ease in work mode. Right? Like, the exertion of effort shouldn't be an obvious exertion. I once ran into an old friend of mine, and he was working on at that point the Simpsons feature film, and which was like years and years and years in the making. And a great film, by the way. It finally came out, but it came out like a bunch of years ago. Anyway, I asked him how it was going, because I knew it was like a long haul, that production. And he said these words to me. He said, you have no idea how much work goes into making something look like no work has gone into it at all. You know? That's an art. It's an art to make something just sort of like look easy. And I once thought, like a long time ago, that, you know, you can invite someone to Shabbos, right? And you can say, hey, what are you doing Friday night? And they say, oh, nothing. Would you like to come? Absolutely. So that whole conversation took 30 seconds, right? But when they come to your Shabbos table, that atmosphere has been years and years in the making. You know? Like, they're entering into something. They're not just showing up to a meal. Like, everyone's Shabbos table, that's like a vibe that you've crafted. Now, either consciously or unconsciously. But it's a thing, you know? Like, people have certain dishes. Like, we have mango salsa. And it's just like one of our staples. But, like, for most people, they're like, mango salsa. fresh mango salsa, by the way. You know? But that's like, to me, it's like, well, of course there's mango salsa. It's Shabbos. Right? And like, my wife came across this recipe at some point. It's a chickpea dish. Right? Now, normally, I don't know. Some people like chickpeas. I don't get excited about chickpeas. But this is actually a chickpea dish to get excited about. Like, people who have like $1 billion, approximately, have come to our house, and they only want to talk about the chickpeas. And my wife has actually gone to their house, and as a present, has given them chickpeas. This chickpea, it's like, but for us, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like there's the mango salsa. There's the chickpea dish. But what I'm trying to say is that if you think about your own table, you have the equivalent of that as well, right? So, but how long did it take? It took a few moments to invite someone into a world that took years to build. And so this idea of flowing upstream. So I had a bunch of like kooky events that happened to me this week, and I just kind of run through them quickly. One was, you know, it's a big highlight of my week to turn off the phone before Shabbos starts. And I often say these words to myself, which is, you're not the master of me, I'm the master of you. And it's like a big moment, you know? Turn off my phone, then, you know, that's usually the last thing I do more or less before I go off to shul. Anyway, this week, my alarm went off at 5:15 in the morning, which I had set it for. And my first thought was, why is my alarm going off on Shabbos? I don't understand. It was so disorienting. And then I thought, well, wait, it's not Shabbos. It's Friday. And by the way, it was Wednesday. And then I thought, wait, I know it's Friday because I had an Aliyah yesterday. But then I realized, no, it's Thursday. It's Thursday. And then I realized it was Wednesday, and I was so happy because I was like, I had the fullest week and it's only Wednesday. I felt so good. And then I got ready to go for shul, and as I was leaving the house, I thought to myself, this thought came into my head, it's Wednesday, where did the week go? You know, time, right? Time. David Weiss spoke here on Shabbos, and it was so amazing. And he was talking about, he didn't use these terms, but essentially being your own best friend. It's really important, you know, to be your own best friend, to be your own cheerleader. And because we have enough people in the world to knock us down, right? And all of us need levels of reassurance that we're probably embarrassed about. My dad, who is a psychologist, Olav Shalom, he used to say, you never outgrow the need. No person ever outgrows the need for validation. And in my own life, I saw that with Reb Shlomo more than once. This happened, maybe two times, maybe three times to me, where he gave a talk, he gave over, you know, some Torah that will probably be learned for hundreds of years. And after he said it, he just kind of came up to me and whispered in my ear, was that okay?
Wow.
Now, can you imagine? Can you imagine? So to me, that's an illustration, that's validation of what my dad was saying, that a person never outgrows the need for validation. And it's hard to ask it from another person on a constant basis. If you are, stop. That's my advice. Just don't do that. I can tell you that, you know, sometimes, that doesn't mean you can't ask every once in a while, but I'm talking about it on a constant basis. But the point is that you can give yourself that validation on a constant basis. It's not too much to ask for from yourself. And you can actually provide that for yourself. So that's what I'm talking about, being your own best friend. Like, self-talk is so... I heard someone say one time that it's a sign of intelligence to talk to yourself. It's a sign of madness to answer yourself. Right? That's where it gets a little tricky, you know? But to talk to yourself is very, I think it's very healthy. But, and to talk to God, that is the core of everything. And that's Rabbi Nachman, right? Rabbi Nachman of Breslov says, talk to God like he's your best friend. And that, I'm telling you, is absolutely the key to everything. That's the key to everything. Because why? Because there's nothing like talking. You know, how do you make a friend? How do you make a friend? So imagine you go to a party or, you know, whatever, or you're in a supermarket, whatever it is, and you meet someone, and it's like, oh, you like that thing? I like that thing too. Where did you find out that thing? Oh, from the, I know that guy. We went to camp together. Are you kidding me? Wow. You know something? I remember his favorite band was so-and-so. Actually, really? Because they're coming into town. I have tickets. I love that. Do you want to go to that concert together? So you go home and you're like, you know, I think I just made a friend. So how did you make the friend? By talking. It happened through talking. So that's how you make friends, right? But also listening is part of that. If you're doing all the talking, something's wrong, right? Got to be listening also. It's got to be an actual conversation. Go back and forth. Someone was just asking me, they said, I've just been invited to be a guest on a podcast. I said, any advice? I said, yes. I said, you're going to do fine. Just don't talk too long. Right? And I remember I did a TV appearance on something. And I asked the person, I said, how long is it okay to talk for? Because it was sort of like a panel, you know? And he said to me, 30 seconds is plenty. You know? So I was like, okay, right? Whenever anyone asks me to speak at a shul or whatever it is, the first question I always say is, how long is this slot for? Right? That's, you have to just be sensitive, right? So anyway, you make friends through talking and listening. And if that's true for people, it's 100 times more true for God. You will make a friend out of God. You will make God real through talking to God. And remember, how did God create the universe? So our sages say that he spoke the world into creation. He spoke the world into creation. So in other words, a relationship happens through speech. Creation, you create worlds, you create everything through that talking. I'll tell you something like super, super deep. There are halachic ways, and if you look in the back of the Mishnah Berurah, it tells you how to write the letters of the Hebrew alphabet al pi halacha, according to Jewish law. And, you know, the way you see it in a book isn't necessarily how they're written in a Torah scroll. But they have to be written in a particular way for a Torah scroll. And again, in the Mishnah Berurah, it goes through how to write each letter. So one of the fascinating things is, and this is going to be a little bit hard to imagine, so just take my word for it. But if you want to kind of look it up and see the visual of it, you can Google it, and then you'll really see it. But what I'm telling you right now is going to be a little bit abstract in a moment. So if you look at the letter Bez, I'm sorry, let me start again. If you look at the letter Pei has to be written in such a way where there's the letter Bez in white inside of it. So in other words, imagine a black letter Pei. There has to be a white letter Bez in the center of it. Okay. So now listen to this. Imagine you've got a black letter Bez in the center. That means that there's a white letter Pei around it. Do you understand? So if the first letter of the Torah is the Bez of Breishis, and all of Breishis is contained within the letter Bez, in other words, all of creation is contained within that black letter base. And there's a white fire pei around it. Pei and peh are basically the same word. A white fire peh speaking out, that's Hashem, so to speak, speaking out the creation of the world. That's the white fire peh, and then there's the black fire bays right in the center of it. That's wild. That's wild. That's wild. That's wild. That's wild, actually. Because remember, the black of the Torah is the revealed aspects of creation. So that bays is black. That's the revealed aspect. That's the universe. But the white fire pei around it, that's the peh, that's the speech of Hashem speaking it into the world, that we can't see with our eyes. So I asked a question on Shabbos, and I didn't really mean to create a discussion, but here was the question, and I want to go into it a little bit more deeply, which is, what would you rather be in? A windowless room that's cramped, or to be alone in the middle of the desert and not know which direction to walk in? So I was surprised. I was just kind of starting off that way. Basically, the point that I wanted to get to was that the finite is also infinite. That might sound like a little bit of a leap starting from there, but anyway, the finite is also infinite. So I was surprised because there was a person there who doesn't normally come to the talks because she lives in Israel. And she said, well, I was just in the army and I was stationed in a desert unit and I was in the middle of the desert and I was by myself. I was like, wow, I had no idea that this would, I thought this was like a totally theoretical, abstract question. And like someone is like totally relating to it from their own life. And she said, I think that I would rather be alone in the desert, not knowing which way to go. And then she said these words. She says, because if you get lost, you can find your way back. I thought that was so symbolic, you know? And then she turned to the people behind her and she said, would anyone rather be in a closed room? And someone said, I would. I was like, wow, this is great. And the person said exactly what I was thinking. They said on their own, which was, I really appreciate the security of the walls around me. And that's very real. That's very real. But you see, it's also problematic. It's real and it's problematic. Why is it problematic? Because a lot of times we are comforted by our own misery. Because we're so used to it. And we make friends with our misery. And then you get into this totally dysfunctional place where you don't want to leave your good friend misery behind. What kind of friend am I? I'm abandoning my misery. Am I so disloyal? So how do you leave your misery behind when it's become your good friend? When it's become your security blanket? By the way, I'm going to tell you something which can change your life right now. If you don't know about this, you ready? Two words. Weighted blankets. If you don't know about this, if you don't know about this, and you are a candidate, and you are a candidate for one of these, I have just made your life appreciably better. Okay? And shop around, because the price spread online is like really big. Like, I think they go for anywhere, the same product from like $30 to like $150. So you just shop around a little and get a good price on one. But what is a weighted blanket? Basically, you can sleep by yourself and someone will be hugging you the entire night. That is what a weighted blanket is. And it provides, it's like mental health's best friend, because it provides you with this physicalized sense of security that you actually are like being hugged in a very welcome way. And they come in different weights, by the way. So from like very heavy to on the lighter side. I think my wife said that we have the 15-pound one, something like that. I don't know, but I think 12-pound. Okay, there's 12-pound also. And then they get more. So, yeah, too heavy. Right. You don't want too heavy. So, you know, you can start with a lighter one and then see where it goes. But anyway, I haven't tried it yet, but I have heard raves from people. And you don't have to be like it's just a comfort thing. You don't have to be someone who's, you know, like really like out there. It's just like a nice thing. It's just like a nice thing. So anyway, keep that in mind. So a lot of people don't want to let go of their good friend misery because it's become so comfortable. And yet these walls aren't necessarily ultimately healthy, you know? Because while they provide an element of security, I'm going to tell you something heartbreaking. This was heartbreaking for me. I knew a guy, a very, very righteous person, very righteous. He's not in this world anymore. Really a beautiful individual. And God forbid, I'm not saying anything bad, but I am reporting a real thing right now. And he was pretty darn functional. But he had his challenges. And he was able to get what's called SSI, which is a stipend from the government for people who are disabled and who can't really work. Okay, he was pretty borderline, meaning to say that he probably was more capable. He certainly was more capable than he gave himself credit for. And he was also skilled in a very particular field, that there was money to be made in this field, okay? And I remember I used to help him out and in however I could. And I remember he was showing me this product that he had, which was a real professional product. And this was years and years into knowing him. And I said to him, you know, if you do, like I was trying to like structure a business for him because I was seeing income there, you know? And I was saying, you know, if you do this, if you do that, you can have money coming in from this, more money than you're making, and it's going to be a good thing. And he said to me these words that were like scarring to me. He said, if I make over a certain amount of money, and it was a very low amount of money, he said, I won't be able to receive this stipend from the government anymore. And so I don't want to do that. Now that's a person who's in the windowless, cramped room and doesn't want to leave. And that was really sad to me. That was sad to me because I knew that he could do it, but he was afraid. He was afraid because there was a certain reliable check that was coming in, as small as it was, but it was enough for him to just kind of get by. And so we need, for those of us who are in that category, and by the way, I think all of us, at whatever level we're at, are in that category. Because it could be that our windowless room is like, you know, like as large as a loft in downtown New York, but you're still behind four walls, right? So there is, as long as we breathe, there is no new height that we can't rise to. And to the extent that we go, okay, this is good, that's death. That's not only death, but that's where old age kicks in. So we need a new narrative. That's what it is. Now, I heard this, like, you know, public radio type thing, and I didn't listen to the whole thing. We were kind of driving someplace. But I was so compelled by the beginning of this. They said, and now we're going to have a marriage counselor on. And this marriage counselor is, like, become famous because all marriages that are absolutely falling apart, she's been able to wondrously fix. And we're going to talk to her right now. I was like, I'm listening. You know what I mean? Like, you have an introduction like that, you can have the best marriage in the world. It's like, what? What do you have to say? And I heard like the first 5 minutes of what she said. But I was so intrigued by this because I really believe that it's true. She said, they said to her, they started off, first question, how are you so successful? And she said, because I'm able to provide the couple with a new narrative. You see, we're all part of a story. Remember, the first, what does the Zohar say? The Zohar says that the whole Torah can be contained, is contained in the first word of the Torah. The whole Torah is contained in Bereishis. What does Bereishis mean? In the beginning, or out of beginnings. And I heard Rabbi Tatz say the word beginnings, that's the first word, implies middle and end. Meaning to say the very first word of the Torah, which is the blueprint of reality, the very first word is telling you we're on a journey. A journey is unfolding. So the in other words, a story, I'm putting it in my words, a story is being told. God is telling a story through you. You are telling a story through your choices. And guess what? You get to decide what story you want to tell with your life. And you can change that at any moment. You know, I'll just give you a snapshot of what it means to get a TV show on the air, okay? So I've been extremely fortunate over my career. I've gotten several TV shows on the air. It's very hard to do. It's very, very hard to do. So let me just tell you the process, because on the one hand, I'm telling you that, but really, I'm telling you for a different reason. I'm telling you about how you can decide what story you want to tell with your life. That's the point of this. Okay, so let's say you come up with an idea, right? So you gotta flesh it out. And then, and you need characters, you need sample stories, you need to answer the question, why this show now? In other words, there has to be a zeitgeist relevance that is compelling about the idea that will make this streamer, whatever it is, feel like, oh yeah, this is what people wanna watch. Like, you can't just come up with a good show. You have to come up with a good show that the network thinks people want to watch right now. That's because that's their business thing. That's how they're hearing it, right? So all of these elements have to come into place. So you come up with a show, and now you go, okay, well, I have a meeting with whoever it is. Will they like it or won't like it, right? Let's say they like it. Okay, that's great. So it's sort of like, are they going to buy it or are they not going to buy it? Okay, let's say now then they made an offer. Wow, okay. Now you have to write a script, a pilot script. So now you go, is this script going to come out well or is it not going to come out well? Then you work really hard on it and you go, oh, okay. And then you have a new one. Are they going to like it or are they not going to like it? And then let's say they like it. And then maybe they'll give it a pilot order, not a series order, but a pilot order. Give you a pilot order. You go, okay, well, you know, wow, I got a pilot order. That's good. Who's going to agree to be in this? Am I going to get a good star or not? Someone who, like, will add commercial appeal to it. So either someone will say yes to it or say no to it. Can I get that person? Then you get that person. Then you get these other people. Will they have chemistry with each other? Will they not have chemistry with each other? Then you shoot the thing. It's sort of like, is it going to come out as good as the script was? Because a lot of times you'll have a funny script and then the thing that you shoot is resolutely unfunny, right? Believe me, you know? Sometimes, and I've been on productions like this, it's funnier than the script. And it's like, wow, then you know you have something, right? So then you've got the pilot and it came out good. But it's up against all these other pilots and there are only a few slots. Are they going to order the show or are they not going to order the show? So then let's say they order the show. So now you've got, now you're going to make the show. Okay, you make the show. Then it's sort of like, what kind of time slot are they going to give it? Like this is back in the days of network, right? So, because they can give it a lousy time slot. What's it up against? Then are they advertising it or not? Because you can have a very good product and no one watches it. So then let's say the first episode gets big ratings. It's not a hit yet. Because that just means a lot of people decided whether they want to watch it again or not. So then after you get those first ratings, it's like, has everyone decided en masse that they like the show, or has everyone en masse decided that they don't like the show? And also, what kind of reviews did it get? Sometimes the reviews matter, sometimes the reviews don't matter. So what I'm trying to tell you is that every single step of the way, there is something positive to focus on, or there's something negative to focus on. In other words, you can be dragged through the mud towards success the entire way. If that's how you choose to live your life. Everything can literally be going your way, but every step of the way, you're in fear, so you are literally being dragged through success. Or you can, and here's the key word, you can choose. You can consciously choose to focus on the positive. Now that's actually a muscle that has to be developed because we're sort of hardwired to be in this windowless room that offers the security of at least no one's going to kick me out of this room because no one wants to be in it. So I've got this for me. No one's coming. This is mine. And again, that offers a certain comfort, but it's a toxic comfort, ultimately. It's a toxic comfort. So that's what I'm talking about creating your narrative. Creating your narrative is consciously choosing to see the positive. Now, I had a very interesting back and forth with someone, and someone is going through a very hard time. And I said these words. I don't know if these words were meaningful to them, but they've stayed with me. I said, you know something? I validated them because it was true. You are going through a hard time. This is real. I said, but it's going to pass. I said, a good time is coming. And I said, because they were sort of wondering what to do in the present, and the choices that they had mentioned to me, for me, didn't seem to be very positive at all. They all seemed to be not so positive. And I said, a better time is coming. Be the person now that you're going to be proud to have been then. When the good time comes later, be the person now that when the struggle passes, you can look back on the choices that you made, and from the standpoint of these hard tests having passed, you can be proud of the person that you were when it was tough. So let's go deeper into that for a moment. Remember I told you, I asked the question, would you rather be in the cramped room without any windows or alone in the open desert? And the woman said, well, I was just in an Israeli military unit and I was alone in the desert. And then she said, I was sleeping in a tent next to someone. Because I asked, because there's always this detail in the Torah that for some reason sort of like, you know, just made such an impression on me, which was that there were snakes and scorpions in the desert. You know, we kind of think of the desert as a sort of like par of entity. It's like a lot of sand. A lot of sand and snakes and scorpions. You know what I mean? It's like it's like not such a great place. And so I asked her, I said, were there snakes and scorpions? And were you trained by the military how to deal with those? And she said, yes. And she said that, and it's so funny because this is, I guess, life-saving advice, but it sounds pretty simple. She says, they say, when you see a rock, kick it. So now we've all been trained by the Israelis. We're all members of the IDF now, you know? Right? Because that's where they really like to hang at. The snakes and the scorpions by rocks, you know? And if you're going to go to sleep, for sure, if you're going to put your head on a rock or something like that, for sure, check around it. Okay. So she says that she went to sleep in a tent, and the person, the fellow soldier that she was, you know, next to, the next day, he got up and was like, oh, my foot, it's swollen, it hurts so much, ah! He was in incredible pain, and they looked, and he was bitten by a snake in the middle of the night. Wow. Now, he survived. But, and then she kind of kept on talking, and I was like, wait a second, wait. You mean he got bitten by a snake in the middle of the night and he didn't know it? Like, I didn't know that was possible. And then I thought, how many of us in our regular lives have been bitten by a snake and we didn't even realize that it happened? Right? In other words, some highly negative thing has entered into our life, and in real time, we're not even aware of it. See, this is why the mitzvahs are so good. Because the mitzvahs really keep us in a higher state of awareness, a higher state of consciousness. So that we have like a real definition and a real radar for toxicity. We do in a way that most people don't, because it just makes us hypersensitive in a very positive way, hopefully. I mean, it can also make you hypersensitive in a very neurotic way, but you know, you have to see someone there. As a very prominent rabbi who I love a lot said, if you're a Baal Tshuva, you must go to a psychologist. And he did not mean that in that you're crazy. He meant that in that there is so much to absorb and to integrate that you have to work it through in a disciplined, conscious way. And there's no sign that you're lacking or that you're mentally ill in some way, chas v'shalom. God, it's just too much for the brain to absorb, basically. You need a program. Remember, Rabbi Shlomo Seidenfeld likes to say, and I love to quote him, which is that the word halacha, which means Jewish law, has the word holech in it. Holech means to walk and not to run. To walk. In other words, there's a conscious integration going on in how you proceed with it. In life. So the mitzvahs, the mitzvahs can absolutely save us. And my wife came up with something that I thought was just fantastic. So I want to share it with you. As AI becomes ever more advanced, and it's just like, it's really speeding. By the way, if anyone is looking for a business opportunity, look into AI, okay? Because it's crazy what's opening up. And for instance, now in terms of filmmaking, and this is like right at the beginning, You're not too late to get into this. And you're not too late to become an expert at this, both in animation and in seeming live action. You know, if you can devote some time to that, I'm telling you, anyone who's looking for a business, there's serious, serious, serious money to be made there. Okay. So AI is becoming more and more advanced. Now, Apple came out with these things called the Vision Pro goggles, which you may or may not try. I have not tried them yet. But I've read a couple of reviews. And the one thing that everyone seems to agree on, like, you know, people like it, they're waiting for the more advanced models, all the rest. But there's one feature on that I'm super intrigued by and everyone seems to really like, which is imagine you've got the middle seat on an airplane, right? Most people don't like the middle seat. And this could be for the aisle or the window also. But just to make it stronger, say you're in the middle seat. You can put on these goggles and you can have a 360 view that you are on a beach in Malibu. 360. Or if you want to be in the Alps, you are in the Alps. Or if you want to be in outer space, you are in outer space 360. Okay? And people are digging that, right? For good reason. Now, we have already seen the trend of technology making people more and more isolated in their lives. The more social media, the more aloneness. And I'm choosing that word carefully. Not just the more by yourselfness, the more aloneness. And it's this really toxic cocktail because, you know, you get a like, you get some likes, and it hits your endorphins so that you get this positive, you know, buzz, and you feel good about yourself, and you know, little adrenaline rush, whatever it is. But basically, it's driving you further and further toward a brick wall. So it's not great, because it's basically positively reinforcing your own aloneness and your own sense of isolation, which is ultimately emotionally crippling. So it's kind of like aiding and abetting you into a pit, okay? So my point is that this new breakthrough, which is that you can sit in the middle aisle and you can be in Malibu, is just leading us more and more toward this sense that, okay, so I've got, like, it's not even a one bedroom. It's a bachelor apartment, right? Like, basically, I'm sleeping in the same room as the kitchen. There isn't even a bedroom. But you know what? With my Vision Pro goggles, I'm in Malibu, so what do I care? What's the point? How does this tie into how the mitzvahs are going to save us? Because guess what? You have to show up to a minyan. In other words, the structure of the mitzvot themselves mandate human interaction, mandate community. You will be pulled from the fire and rescued. And now when you think about, as the world becomes more and more transformed technologically, things that we think are so basic and that we never even thought twice about, all of a sudden become these revolutionary social constructs. Like these things that just seem so like, yeah, well, whatever, become like revolutionary breakthroughs in society. And you realize the eternality of the Torah. And we're right now at the cusp of it. We ourselves in our lifetime. Right? Like if you ever wondered what it was like, because there was like just a patch of years in like, you know, around 1914 approximately, where like all of a sudden there were airplanes. You know what I mean? Like the idea that you could live in Los Angeles and go to China. What are you talking about? Now it's like, okay, if you've got some bucks, what are you doing this afternoon? You want to go to China? You know, they'd be very happy to take you to China. You know, just give them your credit card. They have no problem whatsoever. You know? So there was a period of a few years. You want to talk to someone who's on the other side of the country? Oh, well, here's a telephone. What? What are you talking about? Like there were so many absolutely radical transformations. The car, right? You want to visit your relative who, like, lives in another state? Yeah, it's like an hour away. Really? What's my point? If you want to know what was that like living through that, we're doing it right now. It's happening right now. We're going through another one of those tectonic shifts in the way society is organized right now, right now. You see, I tell you something. I read this once in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. I didn't remember who said it, but we have a false way of thinking about technological advance, which is we tend to think that, like, for instance, once they're flying cars, okay, I can give you other examples, but let's just use that for to begin with. Once they're flying cars, you're going to say, okay, everyone's going to have a flying car. Not true. Once they're flying cars, some people will have flying cars and other people will have regular cars. Once the cell phone was introduced, you say, well, everyone's going to have a cell phone. Not true. People will have land phones and other people will also have cell phones. Right? In other words, when technological breakthroughs happen, they don't just become the new now. There's a transition that takes place. And in that transition, you're not necessarily aware that it's even happening. You don't know the implications of what's even happening as it's happening in front of your face. Because it's not that radical on-off black-white thing. And so all of these things, which are going to forever change the way we go through life, have now already been implanted in front of us right now and are taking root. It's just that the old stuff is still here at the same time. Okay. We're going to wrap it up. Just want to tell you something. I had a crazy, crazy thought. Just share it with you. So yesterday on Shabbos during Shacharis, I was getting ready to say Shema. And, you know, if you wear a talis, there's kind of like, the moments before Shema are sort of like a busy time. you have to gather the four corners of your talis together, your tzitzis together, right? And sometimes you can be hunting for it behind your back, depending on how your talis is currently sitting on your body, you know? Sometimes it's a little maddening and frustrating. Sometimes it's very easy. You've sort of thought ahead and they're all kind of ready for you. But you gather them in, and on a symbolic level, that's the idea of all the Jewish people coming together as one from the four corners of the world, okay? It's like the ingathering of the exiles. So you gather them all together, and then there's a way that you sort of hold them. You kind of thread them through your fingers in a certain pattern, and then it's good to take the tzitzis that have been gathered and to place it against your heart, right? That's a good holding position for them to be over here. And so as I was doing that, I needed two hands to do that, so I couldn't be holding my prayer book. So I put it on my lap, and last week I had the, you know, high honor of being the sandek at someone's bris. So if you're not familiar with that term, when they circumcise the baby, they put it on someone's lap. And you're supposed to pick someone, usually it's the grandparent, that's often the go-to person for the sandek. But if someone's, you know, out of town or whatever it is, or has moved, and you know, sometimes you don't have access to someone like that, and you can use anyone. Many people will use the biggest rabbi that they know, right? Or someone, you know, whoever it is. But it's good to pick someone that, because they say that that person will have a spiritual influence on the child. So you want to pick someone. So anyway, I had that opportunity. And as I was sitting down, the moyel, the person who was going to do the circumcision, said to me, "Hold your knees tightly together," right? Because they want a nice foundation for the baby, very bedrock. So I did that. And so yesterday, as I was gathering my tzitzis, I put my prayer book on my lap, and I felt like a sandek. And I thought to myself, but like the prayer book is the baby, and there it is on my lap. And then I thought, but where's the circumcision itself? And then I thought to myself, wow, I'm about to say Shema. That's the circumcision of the heart. I'm about to circumcise my heart. And then I realized, wow, I am the sandek at my own circumcision. Which is a wild thing, because when is the baby ever the sandek at his own circumcision? The answer is never. I heard someone ask me a brain teaser one time. He said, during benching, when do you say magdil and migdol during the same benching? And the answer is when you're wrong. So when are you the sandek and the person being circumcised? Never is the answer. But we can do that for ourselves. We can do that for ourselves. And by the way, you can have this kavana also if you're a woman. You just have the sitter on your lap. And you just have in mind that you're circumcising your heart, because that's for men and women every day, all the time as well. And so let me just conclude by going back to where we started. What does it mean to be the sandek and the person getting circumcised at the same time? That's the idea of being your own best friend. That's the idea of being your own best friend. So to be the sandek at your own bris means to knock down those four walls and to invite the infinite. We never outgrow the need for being validated. No matter how much success a person experiences, every single person needs to hear, you know, you're doing good. You're doing good. Good job. Good job. Every person needs to hear that. And you can say that to yourself at all times, right? And that's a beautiful thing. I'll just end with this. One of the greatest things I ever heard, someone who I know, beautiful person, she was walking into the room, and her, I don't know how old the child was, maybe three, let's say 3 years old, around that age. And maybe younger, I don't know, but she was trying to climb on top of a chair. And it was just because of her age and size, it was very challenging for her to be able to do that. And it wasn't anything dangerous or anything like that. And so the mother was just kind of walking in and then saw that her child was like in the middle of something, and she wanted to just watch, you know? And this child, whose name was Chana, got to the top of the chair, didn't see her mom. She just thought she was all alone. She got to the top of the chair and she said, "Good job, Chana." Okay.
Thanks for listening. We do this every week, so join in again next Sunday for a new podcast where we explore the amazingness of life. And review us and send in any comments or suggestions. I'd love to hear them.